Okay, welcome everyone back to our In the Eyes of Our Brothers Shear. We are up to Yehuda Part 4. To preface before we begin, so there's a whole big thing in Shul, whether what we're going to do next week, are we going to go chronologically or are we going to go biologically? Chronologically, the next one would be to do Dan, and probably Dan and Naphtali together, right? Those are the two sons that were born next to Bilhah. And then after Dan and Naphtali, then Gad and Asher, who were born to Zilpah, then Yisachar and Zvulun are born to Leah. So unclear. So we had a whole thing if we were going to do Yisachar and Zvulun next or Dan and Naphtali. I think we, what did we decide? I think we decided we're going to do Dan and Naphtali next week. So that's where it gets the most interesting, because those are the ones who we know nothing about in Tanakh, or at least in Bereishis. So God willing, I look forward to that. But for now, let's conclude with talking about Yehuda. So we spoke about Yehuda. We've been speaking about him for the past 4 weeks, and the first 3 weeks we spoke about the fact that Yehuda is clearly an individual who is from not so early on, but ultimately ends up being considered the leader of the family, the clear next generation of who is going to be the one ruling over everyone, the Malchus. He's the one who has the kingship for the family, and that's very indicated in the fact and the blessing that Yaakov gets. Yehuda gets from Yaakov. Take a look at source number 1 in Perek Mem Tes, chapter 49, Psukim Ches through Yud Beis. It's a very long bracha. I think the longest bracha that any of the other brothers gets. And in this bracha, you just see how he waxes poetic to talk about the greatness of Yehuda. We'll read it in the English. Yehuda, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down before you. Yehuda is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched like a lion, as a lion. It's very poetic, but clearly just saying how great Yehuda is and how great he will be, how he'll continue to evolve and become even greater as a tribe and as a family. The scepter will not depart from Yehuda, nor will the ruler's staff, etc., etc. And it's just clear how highly he thinks of Yehuda. And of course, the obvious question is, what makes Yehuda so great? And we develop that a little bit. We began speaking about all the various incidents in his life that made him, that defined his greatness, that were sort of the pivotal moments for him. What I wanted to suggest, I think last time when we spoke, was the notion that everyone loves to point to the Yehuda and Tamar story, right? When he said famously, "Tzadka mimeni," that she is more righteous than I. That's usually the classical source that people use to define the beginning of the leadership of Yehuda. But I wanted to say that maybe Parshas Vayigash was actually the beginning of that, when Yehuda, for the first time, takes the leadership role without being prefaced by a Reuven or someone else stepping in beforehand. However, that said, it is clear that even if that is true, even if Yehuda at the beginning of Parshas Vayigash, when he stands up to Yosef, if you remember that we spoke about last week, when he makes that stance, it's clear that he's the leader at this point. But the first real sense that you get that, wow, this guy is going to be something special, is the Yehuda and Tamar story. And it would seem, according to many of the Mefarshim, therefore, that when Yaakov is giving Yehuda this bracha and saying, "Hey, Yehuda, I know that you're so great, you're going to be great," it's specifically because he's alluding to the fact that this greatness all began when he recognized his wrongs and did tshuva for them when he during the Yehuda and Tamar story. Take a look at source number 2 in the Targum HaMiyuchas LeYonatan, in which he says in Aramaic, but we'll read it in English. And I apologize for the old English translation, but he says, "Yehuda, thou didst make confession in the matter of Tamar," meaning that's how the Targum explains the Pasuk. The Targum is usually just a translation of the Pasuk into Aramaic, but then sometimes he adds as a commentary. So the commentary to the Pasuk is, why is Yaakov so proud of Yehuda? Why does he, quote-unquote, know that he's going to become a great leader? Because of the fact that he made that big confession with Tamar, that he said, "You are more righteous than I, tzadka mimeni," and therefore, it must be that you are going to become great. There are great things that are going to come from you. Keep reading, though. It's very interesting. He says, "Therefore shall thy brethren confess thee, and shall be called Yehudim from thy name." Very interesting. The Targum says quite early on that Yaakov was actually the one to, in a sense, prophesy that we were going to be called Jews, right? The fact that we're called Jews, that this is called Judaism, is very odd, because we are not Jews, we're Israelites. If anything, we come from Yaakov, or we're Yitzchakites or Avrahamites. We're not we're not Jews, although of course many of us probably are, couldn't trace ourselves back to Yehuda, but nonetheless, the Jewish nation is much larger than the tribe of Yehuda, but evidently Yaakov prophesied over here that it was going to be the case that we were all going to call ourselves Jews because of the great leadership that Yehuda showed. And if you take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Sachs Zatzal explains very beautifully in an essay that he wrote several years ago on Parshas Vayigash why it is the case that Yehuda was, what made this incident so particularly special, meaning what is so great about the fact that he just said that she's more righteous than I. Why is that such a unique aspect of his character, and why does that make him so primed to be the leader? So if you take a look at source number 3, however, Yehuda, more than anyone else in the Torah, changes. Yehuda is the first penitent, the first Baal Tshuva in the Torah. Where did it come from, this change in his character? For that, we have to backtrack to chapter 38, the story of Tamar. Tamar, we recall, had married Yehuda's two elder sons, both of whom, we know this already, both of whom had died, leaving her a childless widow. Yehuda, fearing that his third son would share their fate, withheld him from her, thus leaving her unable to remarry and have children. Once she understands her situation, Tamar disguises herself as a prostitute. Yehuda sleeps with her. She becomes pregnant. Yehuda, unaware of the disguise, concludes that she must have had a forbidden relationship and orders her to be put to death. At this point, Tamar, who, while disguised, had taken Yehuda's seal, his cord, and his staff as a pledge, sent them to Yehuda with a message. The father of my child is the man to whom these belong. Yehuda now understands the whole story. Not only has he placed Tamar in an impossible situation of living widowhood, and not only is he the father of her child, but he also realizes that she has behaved with extraordinary discretion in revealing the truth without shaming him. It is from this act of Tamar's that we derive the rule that one should rather throw himself into a fiery furnace than shame someone else in public, right? That's what Tamar was about to do. She was allowing herself to be murdered, burnt at the stake, without and not risking letting Yehuda be embarrassed in front of everyone. She wanted Yehuda to admit it, but if he wouldn't have, she would have allowed herself to be killed. Tamar is the heroine of the story, says Rabbi Sachs, but it has one significant consequence. Yehuda admits that he was wrong. She was more righteous than I, Tzadka Mimeni, he says. This is the first time in the Torah someone acknowledges their own guilt, which is a powerful statement. The first time over 2,000 years of history, since the world was created, he was the first time in the Torah someone acknowledges their own guilt. It is also the turning point in Yehuda's life. Here is born that ability to recognize one's own wrongdoing, to feel remorse, and to change. The complex phenomenon known as tshuva that later leads to the great scene in Vayigash, where Yehuda is capable of turning his earlier behavior on its head and doing the opposite of what he had once done before, right? That he defends Binyamin to Yosef instead of how he basically was the reason why Yosef was sold off. Yehuda is Ish Teshuvah, penitential man. We now understand, and I think this paragraph is also fascinating, this last one in source number 3, we now understand the significance of his name. The verb lehodot means two things. It means to thank, which is what Leah has in mind when she gives Yehuda, her fourth son, his name. This time I will thank the Lord. However, it also means to admit or to acknowledge. The biblical term vidoif, confession, then and now, part of the process of tshuva, and according to Maimonides, is the key element. Comes from the same root. Yehuda means he who acknowledged his sins. So part and parcel of what made Yehuda so great was the fact that in his essence was lehodot, was to admit my mistakes when I make them. And since he was able to do that, that's what made him such a great leader. And it seems clear that leaders in Judaism, we believe that someone should and can only lead if they are someone who makes mistakes. Because everyone makes mistakes, but you can't just make the mistakes, you have to live up to your mistakes. And if you live up to your mistakes, then you deserve to be the leader. And not only that, but that's also why, take a look at source number 4, why the Gemara in Yoma and Chaf Beis Amud Beis explains that the kingship was taken from the house of Shaul and moved to the house of David, right? David, of course, is from Yehuda, and Shaul is from the house of from the tribe of Binyamin, but nonetheless, Shaul was made the first king. Why was Shaul made the first king? If you take a look in the Tanakh, it's clear that Shaul looked like a king. He was tall, dark, and handsome. He was everything you'd imagine a king would look like. He wore like a three-piece suit, and he smoked a pipe. He looked like real royalty. And so, of course, he was the king. But says the Gemara, because he had such a perfect lineage, and he had such good yichus, he looked the part. Because of all of those reasons, that's why he was not meant to be king. It's because of the fact that he was so king-like in how he looked that made him not deserving of being a king. Take a look at at source number four. Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. B'pnei ma'al lo nimshecha malchus beis Shaul. Why did the kingship leave the house of Shaul? B'pnei shelo haya bo shum dofi. He was flawless. He was perfect. Zamar Rabbi Yochanan mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yehud Tzadak. Me'in ma'amidim parnes al tzibur el imkin kupa shel shratzim tzuluyelo. Any single time you want to go and appoint a leader over the Jewish people, you can't appoint a leader over a congregation, over a people, unless he has a box full of skeletons. Unless he has skeletons in his closet. You need to have a leader with skeletons in their closet. Why? Because she'im tazuach daito alav omrin lo chazor lacharecha. Because if this guy gets haughty and he thinks, or she thinks, that she's the bee's knees, she thinks that she's he or she could is just the best God's gift to humanity, you say, whoa, let's take a step back. Let's look at that, your past, for a second. Let's see where you come from. You really come from such a fancy, you have lots of skeletons in your closet. And that is what is supposed to bring a leader down to earth, but that will ultimately, if a leader can be humbled, that will make the greatest leader. You can't have a leader with a perfect past, because then it's hard to humble them if they get too ahead of themselves, which is, by the way, an inevitability of leadership. Every leader at sometime or another risks the possibility of, you know, having his leadership, having his power go to his head. It's amazing, or it's important, rather, I guess you could say, to have some bad things in the past, because it's those bad things that make you fit to be a leader, because they humble you. And take a look at source number 5. It's a statement from Rav Nachman Mibreslov. And as Likutei Maran, he says, Ki ikar ha-malchus, what is the central aspect of being a king? Alideya Navaka, nearly. To be humble. If you have humility, you could be a king. If you don't have humility, then you can't be a king. You have no place being a king. If you are more humble, your kingship, your leadership will last longer. If you're not humble enough, your kingship will be ripped out from under your legs. Take a look at source number 6. And so what was that aspect of David that made him so perfect for the king then? Because in the Rabbi Steinzel's commentary on the Gemara, he says, V'lachin David was perfect to be the king. Why? Sheba mimashpacha shehayu ba kama pigmei yichus. David had like the worst family history ever. He had Tamar, first of all, way back when, right? Tamar and her relationship with Yehuda was questionable, and therefore the fact that they had kids from that union, that is, it's an interesting, you know, again, it's not nothing wrong with it, but it's questionable, it's interesting. And then Rus HaMoavia, right? We know that the Gemara says that it's permissible to marry into the Moabite nation if you're marrying a woman, but that it's obviously that the Pasuk says that it's prohibited to marry a man. But the notion of marrying a Moabite in general is something that's interesting, because I remember that Pasuk that says that you can't do it. Chazal say, no, you can marry a Moabite woman, but that's not how you necessarily would read the Pasuk. And therefore, that's also a little interesting about David's past, and that's why Nimshcha Malchuso v'lo King Shaul. That's why David was perfect for the kingship, because he had all these weird things about his past that made him perfect to be a leader. Because anyone who looks perfect, that he can't be a leader. If anyone who was imperfect and recognizes their imperfection, that's a leader. And that ultimately would seem to be why Yehuda was such a great leader, because he was able to recognize his faults and he was able to live up to them. Now, with that, we can then understand perhaps why it is that Yehuda is connected to the Jewish month of Nisan. The Bnei Yisachar in source number 11 writes that when it comes to Nisan, that Yehuda is the perfect link to this month. I don't want to go inside right now, because the truth is that the Bnei Yisachar doesn't actually give a reason why Yehuda fits so well with Nisan, other than the fact that the Pasuk says, we know that regarding Nisan, it says, HaChodesh HaZel Lachem, right? This will be a month for you. That's where we learn the notion, the idea of Rosh Chodesh, etc. And the word Lachem, says the Bnei Yisachar, if you switch around the letters, that's Melech. So he says, that sounds like king, and therefore that sounds like Yehuda. So that's why Yehuda should be linked to Nisan. But it would seem also that there's an even deeper link to the fact that Yehuda is connected to the month of Nisan, that because Yehuda is meant to be a leader, and he identifies and he portrays such incredible leadership qualities, that's why he's so connected to Nisan, because Nisan would seemingly be the month of the beginning of the kings, of the leaders, etc. With that, we now want to spend a few moments trying to understand exactly what are the ultimate lessons to take up from Yehuda. And it would seem that there are several, that there are many, but just to name a few of the key aspects of the leadership of Yehuda that we can take for ourselves, and who we can take that from. And what I mean by that is that Yehuda is not the only one that becomes a great leader. Again, he is the head of the tribe, and he is the beginning of the tribe, but he gives birth to centuries and centuries of kings. And if that's the case, so there's a lot to learn from his descendants, and I want to focus on just a few of them. So we'll go through the sources a little bit, so that will be one aspect, to look at some of his descendants, and to Tanakh and see what we can garner from their leadership. And number two, we're also going to look at anyone in Tanakh, or at least one person in Tanakh in particular, who got the name Yehudi, right? We know that, again, to be called a Jew, even though we are called Jews, and that's just part and parcel to who we are, we know that already, and that's been like that for a very, very long time, well over 2,000 years. Nonetheless, in Tanakh, to be called a Yehudi is an odd thing, because the term Jew is not so common back then. So if someone got called a Yehudi, it must be that they have some aspects of the leadership of Yehuda that might be important for us to take away. So first of all, let's take a look at source number 8. Another aspect of the leadership that the house of Yehuda holds, or one of the aspects of leadership, is found in source number 8 when we learn about the famous Nachshon ben Aminadav. Says the Gemara in Sota on Lamed Zayin Amad Aleph, Amar lo Rabbi Yehuda, lo kach haya maisa, ela ze omer ein ani yored techila liyam, veze omer ein ani yored techila liyam. Most people assume that everyone agrees that Nachshon ben Aminadav was the first person to jump in. Not everyone does agree to that, but there is a machlok about who jumped in first, but according to this one opinion, it's not that what happened was as follows: that one person said, "You jump in first," and then someone said, "No, you jump in first." Right? No one wanted to be that first person to go into the Yamsuf before the sea was split. But Kafatz Nachshon ben Aminadav came along, Nachshon ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda, the Yara the Yam Techila, and he went in first. And because of the fact that Nachshon ben Aminadav went in, the sea split. Everyone went in. Everyone was saved. He was the guy. He was the reason. So the first lesson of understanding who and what qualities anyone from the tribe of Yehuda should embody is the notion that to be a leader, to sort of stand up and be that leader when no one else is willing to. B'makom she'in ish yishadel yos ish, as our rabbis teach us, that when in the place where there's no one else leading, you should be the one who's leading. But there's also another aspect of leadership that we find in the tribe of Yehuda, and that can be found from Kalev ben Yefuna, as we know in the story with the Meraglim, when the spies go to spy out the land, they all return and all 10 of them speak terribly about Eretz Israel, they speak Lashon Hara about the land of Israel, but then you have Kalev and Yehoshua who don't fall prey to that. And in particular, Kalev, who's from the tribe of Yehuda, he seems to take a very special stance on it. Take a look at source number 9. What does Kalev do? Remember, they're Meraglim, the spies, they're all bashing the land of Israel, but then Vayahas Kalev es Ha'am. Kalev says, everyone, calm down, quiet down, everyone. El Moshe, Vayomer Alon Ale, Vyarashnu Osak. And he's there, he says, be quiet, you spies. Let me tell you the truth. We're going to do this. We're going to go up. We're going to get to the land. And if you see from Kalev the attribute of being able to stand up for what's right in horrible and scary circumstances. Everyone was at this point was distraught. The whole nation was crying. The Meraglim were bashing Eretz Yisrael. And now all of a sudden you have Moshe and Aaron who are like, oh my gosh, this is ridiculous. I don't know what's going to be now. And then Kalev says, no, here, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. To be able to stand up for what's right against all odds, that's another aspect of the leadership of the tribe of Yehuda. Then take a look at source number 10. Of course, we saw this with Yehuda himself as well, but now we see it with David too. In Shmuel Beis Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Yud Gimel, chapter 12, chapter Pasuk 13, the Yomer David El Nasan Chatasi Lashem. After David is confronted with the fact that he didn't make the sin, that he did commit the sin, of course, with Bathsheba, he sent Uriah Hiti, he sent her husband out to war, right? It's a little unclear if he did sin, because even though from the text it seems like he certainly did. Our rabbis tell us, I think as we saw a few weeks ago, that he did not sin, but nonetheless, David is the first person to admit, you're right, Nasan, I did sin, and as a result of him admitting and fessing up to his sins immediately, Vayomer Nasan al David, the prophet Nasan says to David, Gam Hashem have your chatas chalos losamas, Hashem has forgiven you because you've really fessed up to your sin, and as a result, you won't die, you will not face any, you won't face any judgment in such a difficult way from this, at least in terms of dying. And so we see, therefore, a third aspect of the leadership of the tribe of Yehuda, which is, again, the ability to admit your wrongs. Now, I will point out, Nechama Price does mention this, which I thought was very interesting, and that is to say that there's also many flaws, or at least one flaw in particular, that we'll share that everyone, all the leaders, or at least many of the leaders in the house of Yehuda, seem to have. And that is a difficulty and a flaw with the opposite gender, with women. And when I say that, I mean, if you look at what happens, well, first of all, let's take a look at Yehuda and Tamar for a second. What happens with Yehuda and Tamar? So Yehuda, he found the prostitute on the street, and right? So the end of the story is very nice. Sad Kamimeni, he fessed up to his sins, but he was with a prostitute. Let's say it like it is. All right, what else do we see? David HaMelech, of course, with the story with Bathsheba and Uriah Hitti, right? That was also kind of questionable what was going on there. And then, of course, we see, take a look at source number 11. I didn't put the pasuk down. So forget about source number 11 right now. But also, we know Shlomo HaMelech, David HaMelech's son, right? What was his main sin? Well, he violated a couple of primary sins, but one of them was that he had 1,000 wives. 1,000 wives. So all of them seem to have some sort of struggle with the opposite gender, which is not the downfall, interestingly, of all of them, but, well, maybe Shlomo a little bit, but what it does for them is that it actually, it's because of that flaw, because of that mistake, that they're empowered to move forward, which is very interesting, right? That's how David, that's his main catalyst moment in which he's able to grow from that. David HaMelech writes Sefer Tehillim because of that. So it is interesting to point it out that flaw seems to be a commonality among many of them. Okay, in terms of the other aspect that we wanted to go down, the other road that we wanted to take a look at, which was the notion of those who are called Yehudi. So who was called Yehudi in Tanakh? Well, one person in particular, of course, I know it's Hanukkah, but in Purim, right? Mordechai is Ish HaYehudi. Take a look at source number 12. Ish Yehudi Hayah B'Shushan HaBirah. There was a Yehudi. There was a Jewish man in the city of Shushan. Ushmo Mordechai ben Yar ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini. He was from the tribe of Binyamin, but he was called Yehudi. What an interesting thing. Why would he be called Yehudi? So there's a machlok. It's not so clear why he was called Yehudi. Take a look at Rashi. Source number 13. Rashi says, you want to know why he's called Yehudi? Because everyone was called Yehudi. You look at Megillas Esther in general, and Yehudi is a word that you see a lot more so than any other sefer in Tanakh. Why were they all called Jews? So says Rashi, source number 13. Al Shagala Am Galus Yehuda. Because of the fact that they were exiled. Right? So historically, what happened when the Judean population, when they were exiled, then they were all called Yehudi. Anyone who was expelled with the kingdom of Yehuda, all the non-Jews called them Yehudim. Even if you were from a different tribe, you got called Yehuda. So if you were from the tribe of Benjamin, but you got exiled with the kingship of Yehuda, right? There were two kingdoms, Yisrael and Yehuda. So at this point, if you were exiled and you were among the kingdom of Yehuda, you would be called a Yehudi. That's just the name that became known of the Jews. However, the Gemara in Megillah in source number 14 says it a little differently, and it says actually that he got the name Yehudi for a very specific reason. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, source number 13, Gemara in Megillah, Yud Gimel Amad Aleph. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Li Olam Binyamin Kasi. Mordechai comes from the tribe of Binyamin. What do you mean he's a Yehudi? V'yamai Kari Le Yehudi. Why is he called Yehudi? Al Shum Shekafar Be'avodah Zarah. Because of the fact he's called a Jew, he's called a Yehudi, because he denied to bow down to Avodah Zarah. Shekol HaKofer Be'avodah Zarah. Anyone who denies to bow down to Avodah Zarah, Nikra Yehudi, is going to be called a Jew. And he brings a pasuk from Daniel to prove this. And basically, in essence, what he's saying over here is that to be a Yehudi, the defining characteristic of being a Jew is being someone who's going to stand up for what's right and not bow down to an idol. Take a look at the source number 15 for the final source for this evening from a book we've quoted before, The Wisdom in the Hebrew Months by Rabbi Zvi Reisman, in which this whole idea is developed with the notion of Yehudi. And he writes as follows. He says, a Medrash adds that a person who rejects idol worship proclaims Hashem's unity to the world, so he is called a Yehudi, a word that is similar to Yechidi, the firm conviction that Hashem is the one and only. It is interesting, by the way, parenthetically, just to point out, it's nice that it sounds like Yechidi, but he's not called Mordechai HaYechidi, he's called Mordechai HaYehudi, but okay. We can deduce, go back in the source, we can deduce from Chazal's words that the title Yehudi describes those who are willing to proclaim their faith in Hashem with Mesiras Nefesh and to repudiate idolatry, even when such defiance will cost them their lives. The heritage of Mesiras Nefesh remained with the tribe of Yehuda throughout the generations. The Talmud teaches that since Yehuda sanctified Hashem's name publicly, he merited that the four letters of Hashem's name are included in the name Yehuda, right? That's interesting. He's the only one of the brothers who has the Yud Kei Vav Kei, those letters in his name. Yehuda's great public sanctification of the name came at the Sea of Reeds, when Nachshon ben Aminadab, the leader of Yehuda, plunged into the sea, and therefore, concludes Rabbi Reisman, to go back to the fact that Yehuda's connected with the month of Nisan, and why is he connected with the month of Nisan? He says, it's now clear why the month of Nisan is associated with Yehuda. Nisan is an auspicious time for miracles, and if Nisan is so called because of the miracles that took place during the month, then it is only appropriate that it should correspond to Yehuda, whose Mesiras Nefesh caused the momentous miracle that took place when the Jews left Egypt during Nisan. With that, we can then conclude, basically, that while there are many lessons we can take from the tribe of Yehuda and from Yehuda as a person in himself, there are four main traits that I think are relevant to take up from all this. Number one, If you want to be like Yehuda, if you want to learn from Yehuda, you have to have Mesiris Nefesh. Like Mordechai did, he had Mesiris Nefesh. He chose to not bow down to idol worship when he was literally going to die, potentially, if he wouldn't do it. To have that Mesiris Nefesh is one aspect of being a leader, one thing we could take from Yehuda. Number two, of course, as we said several times, to admit when you're wrong. Everyone makes mistakes, but those who admit when they're wrong, that's a true leader. Number three, to be able to stand up for what's right, like Caliph Ben Yefuna did when all the spies were screaming terrible things about Eretz Yisrael. He stood up for what's right in front of everyone. That's a leader. Number four, the notion of what Nachshon Ben Aminadav did, the notion of leading, b'makom she'ein ish, to become a leader when there is no one else there who's willing to lead. You be the one to jump in and into the ocean. And because of that, that's what will allow people to arrive safely on the other side of the shore, because you will be the one to jump in. And so ultimately we see that these four attributes can be learned and taken from the tribe of Yehuda and be taken from the person of Yehuda himself, and that these are all aspects that we should try to learn from him and try to utilize for our own lives, because even if none of us are going to be the king, which I don't feel like the odds are, none of us will be king, but nonetheless, they are important aspects to take in our lives for any situation, and God willing, we should all have the ability to, Hashem should bless us with the ability to learn from the incredible tribe of Yehuda. Everyone should have a beautiful night, Shavuot Tov, and a Freilich and Chanukah, and God willing, next week we'll continue with the tribe of Dan.